Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, earlier this year, the story of domestic abuse within church communities made headlines across the country. And one aspect of the story stood out in particular, the shocking claim that aspects of church teaching might actually encourage women to stay in abusive relationships.
One of the outcomes of that story was the formation of a task force within the Anglican Church to address the issue. So we thought we'd catch up with the person leading it, Sandy Grant, particularly in light of the current 16 Days of Action campaign, which started on the 25th of November and ends on December 10, which is Human Rights Day. We're going to talk to Sandy a little later on in the program about what's happening with that. But first up, we're going to hear from Barbara Roberts, who is herself a survivor of domestic abuse, as well as a victim advocate. And she's the author of a book called Not Under Bondage, about abuse and divorce, as well as the co-leader of a blog called Cry for Justice.
Now, before we talk to Barbara, just a warning. We're aware that there may be little ones listening in, or that you might also find this a sensitive topic for yourself. So if that's the case, then why not consider doing something else for the next 15 minutes? If you want to catch up on our discussion later, you'll be able to find this program on publicchristianity.org or via our iTunes feed. Barbara Roberts, thanks for joining us on Life and Faith.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, figures on the rates of domestic abuse within church communities, I imagine these are quite hard to come by, but what's your sense of how prevalent it is within communities of faith? Are we talking the same rates within the general community?
There's not a great deal, if any, really reliable population-based research to indicate the answer to your question, but certainly my observation and what I read from others who are working in the Christian sector of this is that, yes, the rates are very similar, possibly higher than the general community in some of the more, what I would call, hard patriarchal circles of evangelical Christianity.
Barbara, from your experience, is there a denial of this in the church? Do people not, are they not really aware that there is this problem and that it's quite common?
Yes, indeed. It's very common. The denial is not confined to the church. It's also out there in the community, as are the myths about domestic abuse. But I think the denial is probably greater in the church than in the general community.
So why is that? Why do you think it's more common in the church?
A range of reasons. Churches tend to be more conservative organisations, so they're slower to pick up on things than some other parts of the rest of the community are. Some streams within the church have been very strong on gender roles and male headship. Another reason is that churches are terrific places for abusers to hide out in. If you're an abuser, whether it's a child abuser or a domestic abuser, whatever, or just a person who likes to bully people who are in your social group or your club, a church is a fantastic place to go and do it, because Christians, by and large, like to see the good in everybody and are very forgiving and long-suffering and quote-unquote tolerant. And it's a great place for an abuser to get away with what he does covertly while having on the mask of an upstanding, wonderful human being who's following the precepts of Christianity.
So there are cases where church teaching is actually quite open to abuse. Can you give us an example of that?
There is a slogan that's around Christianity, and it goes like this: God hates divorce. Now, that slogan is based on a mistranslation of one of the scriptures from the Old Testament. Some of the better new translations of the Bible correctly translate it and say, when a man hates and divorces his wife, he covers his garment with violence, which is analogous to our expression, he has blood on his hands. So in that verse, the man is doing the hating of his wife and divorcing her. It's nothing to do with God hating, and it's been mistranslated and applied to this idea that God hates divorce, i.e. all divorce. God does not hate all divorce. He hates frivolous and treacherous divorce, but he does not hate divorce that is done on solid grounds when one party has egregiously broken the marital covenant.
If we can draw upon your experience, I mean, you're a survivor of domestic abuse yourself, and I gather that you've spoken to many, many other women who've also been victims. For Christian women you've spoken to, what has been their experience when they've sought help within the church?
Okay, well, first of all, I'll make it clear that the Christian women I speak to are by and large from the evangelical side of Christianity rather than the Catholic or what we would call the liberal streams. What typically happens is that when the victim finally discloses and tentatively seeks help, she may not even name it as abuse at this stage, but she knows the marriage is very unhappy, and she discloses to the church leadership. What typically happens is that, and not all churches are like this, she's distrusted, she's disbelieved, or she's told that there must be something she's doing to contribute to the dynamics, the it takes two to tango myth, and the leadership may unwisely approach the alleged perpetrator and speak to him. Now, perpetrators are fantastic at recruiting people in authority, particularly other males, to collude with them. And most leaders in churches are completely untrained in how to recognise and resist the abuser's invitations to collude with him. And some of the victims are actually excommunicated from their churches and the abuser remains in good standing in the congregation. That's the worst case scenario.
Have you seen, you know, as this issue has been getting a lot more light and a lot more press, have you seen changes in this within the church? Do you have hopes for things to change?
I definitely have hope. Yes, there is change. There are good signs in the Sydney Anglican Diocese, for example. Other streams and groups within the church are attempting to do something. I know that the Lutheran Church of Australia is going to be doing a fairly large community education, church education program on this. So those are a couple of examples. There's also changes happening elsewhere around the world. So the momentum is building for change. There's a lot further to go though.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for sharing your experiences with us and also your wisdom in this area.
You're welcome. Thank you.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking about domestic abuse within the church, and in this part of the program, we're speaking with Sandy Grant as to what can be done about it. Sandy is Senior Minister of St Michael's Cathedral in Wollongong, and he's also heading up the Sydney Anglicans Task Force on Domestic Abuse. Sandy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Justine.
Now, back in 2013, you called for better education of clergy in training colleges on how to deal with domestic abuse. Now, training up the next generation of church leaders is really important, but you've said yourself that when some victims have actually approached ministers for advice, that they have actually been encouraged to stay in abusive relationships. So can you tell us more about that? What is your sense about what church leaders are currently telling women?
In 25 years of ministry, I've never heard any preacher say that domestic abuse is acceptable or that people should just stay. But I've certainly heard from friends and other contacts that that's been their experience. I think it's much less the case now that the general public awareness has also been impacting the church community, and people are far more quickly encouraged to get to a safe place and to seek help, including going to the police, that no one has to submit to domestic violence.
So, Sandy, you're now chairing a task force within the Sydney Anglican Diocese on domestic abuse. How did that come about and what's the aim of the task force?
I was convinced that our responses hadn't always been adequate in one way, because I know my own responses as a pastor to difficult issues. I wasn't always sure what to do, and I'd received no education during theological training or afterwards specific to this issue, which is a particular and complex one. And so I thought that we should do better. I also know that although I think the teachings of the Bible are good and can be applied in beautiful ways, that they can be twisted or misunderstood. And I was concerned that we could do better in guarding against the misuse of the scriptures. We know that of all things, Jesus was always a protector of the vulnerable and a friend of women.
So can you give us an example of some of those teachings? What kinds of things are being potentially abused?
Oh, well, a number of times in the New Testament, a wife is encouraged to submit to her husband. I think that's a loving loyalty to his sacrificial initiatives for the welfare and protection of his family. The Bible never says husbands should make their wives submit, but some men have taken that and assumed that and disobeyed the explicit teaching of Scripture to love their wives sacrificially to protect them, and instead have forced themselves in various abusive and aggressive ways on their wives. It's just completely unacceptable. It's a twisting of Scripture, but it has happened.
The Christian story is also one that values, you know, self-sacrifice and the patient endurance of sufferings. Mm. And it does occur to me that women can often second-guess themselves, and particularly if they've been in abusive relationships, that would even be more the case. So how do you reconcile, or how do you make sense of that? On the one hand, there is a Christian story that values sacrifice, and on the other hand, women might feel particularly, you know, that they need to stay in a terrible situation.
Sure, Justine, there's a couple of things there. We certainly do value sacrifice, and in fact, that can be a trap for the man as well. Sometimes the man is emotionally abused or even physically abused, and the call for him to lay down his life in sacrifice can mean he stays. That's a minority case, but it can work in both directions. More broadly, I think that there's a deep desire within all people for relationships and for good relationships, and they understand that will mean that reconciliation and things like forgiveness have some value and should be explored. And so that impulse is towards hanging on in relationships often. That's not just a Christian thing, although Christians especially value forgiveness, the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our trespasses. But I think it's a more community-wide thing. We saw that even just recently in Sarah Ferguson's documentary hitting home, where women outside I could see any particular faith context still felt strong impulses to stay. They wanted their relationship to succeed if possible. In the Christian churches, we have to note the particular causes that might make people more vulnerable to staying when they should go.
Yeah, it makes it a really complex issue, doesn't it, that it's kind of to do with these intimate relationships. So you've actually been interested in and campaigning for better responses to these situations within the church for a while. How did this become something that you were passionate about and decided that change was necessary on?
I think one of the things that is almost unique to the pastor's role is that when someone comes with a problem in this area, they're wanting him to fulfill several responsibilities. They want him to be the pastoral carer for them in their grief and their distress, but they also want him to be the bringer of some kind of justice in terms of their complaint. When Christians value things like fairness as well as care for the vulnerable, you then start getting into, is the pastor an investigator? Is he the adjudicator, the judge? Or is he the pastoral carer? And then if the other party, the offending or alleged husband as the offender, is in the congregation, he's also got responsibilities of pastoral care there. And it's very hard to fulfill those three or four different roles in the one person. Too often, I think pastors have ended up feeling like that's what they've got to do, and they don't always do much of it as well as they might.
So is that what the task force is trying to do, to sort of train up and equip and give clergy, you know, guidance in these matters?
The first thing we want to do is make sure we do hear the voices of domestic abuse victims within our churches. And then we hope to produce denominational policy on domestic violence and good pastoral practice guidelines for those in church leadership. And then we may have some recommendations for education during theological college training, in the in-service training afterwards, perhaps via our youth institutions as a preventative, helping young men and women see there's no place for it in our Anglican schools, or via our youth works college and youth ministry activities. They're the sort of outcomes we're hoping for.
Wonderful. Well, we'll send you out so you can get started on that work straight away. Thank you so much, Sandy Grant, for talking with us.
Thanks to Natasha and to you, Justine.
Now, domestic abuse isn't a pleasant topic to talk about, but it does thrive on silence, so it's pretty vital that we do discuss it. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, can we encourage you to please seek help? If you're in immediate danger, ring 000. You can also contact the Respect Line for counselling, information and support. And this is a 24-hour hotline that's available 7 days a week. Its number is 1800 737 732. Barbara also mentioned her blog. That address is cryingoutforjustice.com.
You've been listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.